visitors, and if you're so inspired, then sign up as members of ASPG tonight, and then you'll know that you're coming along to everything from here on. You know, this is the sort of top quality interchange that you can expect. So I hope tonight serves as an advertisement for the merits of ASPG, as well as the obvious reasons why you've come along. What I might say before proceeding any further is that tonight, everything that comes over the microphone and speakers in this room is also being recorded, and the Hansard has the capacity to edit out the long silences and all the rest of it and make the eventual recording readily available for people who weren't able to be here and otherwise for the broader record. So just mention the fact that questions, answers and discussion and all the rest of it that we'll hear from our former premiers and from David Bevan, and indeed your questions in the discussion will be recorded. I'm Josh Teague. I'm the member for Hyson in the Adelaide Hills, at the risk of starting to recognise just about everybody in the room, which I'm not going to do, I just recognise all of the current parliamentary colleagues, friends, but I do single out my predecessor as member for Hyson, Isabel Redmond, who's here, and I'm particularly pleased to see you, Isabel, here back at the Parliament. But welcome, one and all, and it's my honour to be the president of this ASPG group, and so hence welcoming you. Some words of introduction to our guests here tonight. Firstly, the Reverend Dr. Lynn Arnold, the Honourable Lynn Arnold, AO, was quite deliberately recalled just last evening. Welcome. Lynn was first elected to the Parliament, as many of you recall, back in 1979, coming in then at the advent of the Tonkin government as member for Salisbury, which has then gone through iterations in terms of Ramsay and that western part of Salisbury. I just note in terms of his time in executive government, Lynn held a number of ministries, including education, technology and employment. And, of course, Lynn succeeded John Bannon as the leader of the Labor Party and the Premier of South Australia in 1992. Through the 93 election, continued on as leader of the opposition before leaving the Parliament in 1994. Since leaving Parliament, Lynn's completed his doctorate he's been ordained as Anglican priest and can be found at the cathedral. He's held numerous roles, including significantly the Chief Executive of World Vision Australia and also Chief Executive of Anglicare SA. The Honourable Dean Brown, AO, is here too. Welcome, Dean and Roz. Dean was elected to the Parliament a couple of different times, firstly in 1973, and as member for Devonport, and later he was elected as member for Alexandra, later Finnis. And before electorate offices and such things, right, in the first time round, Dean, I might get a mention later on.
So sat in the room in the basement.
Yes.
Five other members of Parliament.
Five others in a room and a typing pool, I think, was the name of the game. Now we have electorate offices and we're spread out all over the place. We'll come to it. That was first time round. Dean served in Premier Tonkin's ministry and was Minister of Public Works and Industrial Affairs, before having a term in opposition during the Bannon period. After losing Devonport in 85, Dean was out of Parliament for 6 years and working in private business, and then came back to Parliament as member for Alexandra in 92, in the lead up to the 93 election, came back as Leader of the Opposition. And Dean led the Liberal Party to victory in the 93 election and went on to serve as Premier and Minister of Multicultural and Ethnic Affairs in that period of his premiership until late in 1996. And then afterwards, during the premiership of John Olsen, was serving as Minister for Human Services and then later as Deputy Premier to Premier Kerrin. Then became, following the 2002 election, Deputy Leader of the Opposition, serving till 2005. And Dean went out retiring at the 2006 election. So the twists and turns. David Bevan, I'm going to hand over to in a moment. David might be best known to everyone in the room, and particularly once you hear his voice, if not so often in person. And we're so glad to have you here in person, David. For 2 decades or so, David Bevan has been presenting on morning radio on ABC Adelaide Radio, and before that was a long-time state political reporter for the ABC. And also reporting on courts for the Advertiser and for ABC Radio News. And I won't emphasise for just exactly how long. Suffice to say that we are in expert hands. I'm now, without further ado, going to hand over to David to lead the discussion with our former premiers before there'll be an opportunity for wider discussion. Over to you, David.
Thank you very much, Josh. Now, most of the people in this room lived through that election. You'd have your own personal vivid memories, but not all of you. For some of you, this is ancient history. If you like to stop and think, in 1993, if we were back then, it would be the equivalent of us getting together and talk about an election that had been held in 1963 when Tom Playford was around. Also, there'd be people watching this stream on live streaming thinking, well, this is kind of interesting, but why are they doing it? So just to very quickly paint a picture. Now, these are personal observations. They're just mine. They could be wrong. But it seemed to me that the Labor Party in South Australia owned the 1980s. It must have seemed to them that anything was possible. We had a casino. We had a Formula One Grand Prix. We'd had the Hilton Hotel for a while, but now we had the Hyatt. If you went to a restaurant, there was a chance you would see Clive James or Ringo Starr. When Australia won the America's Cup, Neil Curley was enlisted to oversee our own yacht for the next competition. We could do anything in South Australia. Had Adelaide ever been Don Dunstan's Athens of the South, who cares? We had shoulder pads and we had money and we'd seized the opportunities presented by the Keating reforms of banking regulation and floating the dollar and tariff reductions. We were financial whiz kids. And then, of course, it all turned to ashes in our mouth. The State Bank and the SGIC, between them, lost billions of dollars, and it turned out, much to the shock of us people listening on the radio, that they were guaranteed by the taxpayer. John Bannon would eventually resign, and the Labor Party would turn to Lynn Arnold to save the political furniture. And the Liberals chose Dean Brown to sweep them to an epoch-changing victory. Gentlemen, thank you for being here tonight. Lynn Arnold, do you remember calling the 1993 election?
Oh, very much, because it had been...
Oh, good, because it would be a really short night.
Memory loss has not yet hit me, but the remember the context that we'd been in. I'd been elected premier, or leader, by the caucus 15 months earlier, then a few days later appointed by the governor. My task at that time, because when John said he had to go. He said the polling is just going downhill. I have to leave and hand over. My task was to sail the ship of state into the harbour called the election with as much showing above the waterline as possible when we hit the wharf. In the end, the funnels were still showing. So we knew that we were on a hiding to nothing, but my task was to try and ensure that we made this a serious campaign about serious issues. And so when I called the election on the Wednesday, 6.5 weeks before election day, which was a particularly long period of time, much longer than average, I did it out at Burton Primary School.
Yes.
A lot of history about Burton Primary School for me personally as a local member, but more importantly about the fact that this, to my mind, represented the heart of what the Labour government was seeking to do, looking after people like this, people who were struggling, wanting to achieve in a society like ours. So I chose that as the venue, and I would finally declare defeat at another school, similarly direct primary school on the same basis.
Yeah.
Now, it was a risky strategy, and Chris Sumner, who's here, was not all that amused that I would do it. He wasn't worried about the length of the campaign, but he was worried that the House was still sitting.
Yes.
Because there were bills that we were very keen to get through, and we didn't want those bills to be just abandoned on the proroguing of Parliament. In the end, that there were some problems to that, but on balance, I still think it was important to have the 6.5 weeks. Why? Because we had nowhere else to go but to campaign, and just campaign as hard as we could for as long as we could. It wasn't going to give us victory in the end, but it might give us the best chance of minimising the loss.
Yep. So I remember, because I'd only been given the political round a few weeks before you announced a 6-week campaign, and I remember, and I'd be interested in your comments on the media at some point during the night, but that was back when we had quite a large parliamentary gallery, mm-hmm. and we were all out there at the primary school. It must have been October. It was a hot day, and I was right up there against you, and the scrum was pushing me into Lynn Arnold, and I was trying to stand on my own feet. In the end, I gave up, and Lynn's weight supported me for the next half hour. I just gave up.
Well, that means I could hold back the press. I just couldn't hold back the Liberal Party.
The other memory that I have is that I went back to the ABC newsroom at Collinswood, and Terry Hare, who had been covering politics for the ABC since Tom Playford, and I said, Terry, it's a 6.5 week campaign. And he used a word that we won't use in polite companies, but he basically said, they must be in trouble. And he was right, and that's why you chose 6.5 weeks.
Absolutely.
You were just waiting for Dean to make a mistake.
I don't think that was all that astute of Terry to say
no.
They must be in trouble. I mean, a blind Freddie could have seen we were in trouble.
But I want to put to you that, well, is it fair to say that the party would never have turned to you but for the ruins of the State Bank, with their reputations destroyed, people rightly or wrongly thinking they were either crooks or incompetent, and this is a general feeling out there, they turned to the one person whose integrity was beyond question. You were the last good man. They were using your goodness to salvage something, Lynn.
I mean... Had things not turned out the way they did with the State Bank, and there were many wonderful things happened in the 80s, I mean, you mentioned the bread and circuses a bit, but I want to talk about the submarines and about the manufacturing industry and all those other things that went so seriously right for the state in the 1980s and so on. But had things not turned out, gone pear-shaped on the bank, then Bannon would have gone on being Premier for maybe another term. Who would have succeeded him then? I believe I would have been in the mix to succeed him, but who knows? I mean, this is all counterfactual stuff as to who would happen.
Yeah.
But do you think
at that time they were actually using your... Good on them. I would.
Well, I mean, somebody had to then take over, and I guess my cabinet colleagues felt I was the most logical choice. Bannon felt I was the most logical choice. But in terms of making comments about personality types, I was honoured, and to this day remain so immensely proud of the fact I had a caucus and a cabinet of the calibre I had. My cabinet met for the last time 2 days after the election. On the Monday, you'd wanted us to resign on the Sunday so you could take over, and that was fair enough. And I said, no, we're going to have one last cabinet meeting, and it was a bit like a last supper. But half the cabinet ministers around the table had lost their seats.
Yeah.
And yet the camaraderie, the solidarity, the I don't know, there was just esprit de corps of this people. It was a privilege to have led them, albeit to such a result.
Now, there was another person who made the observation that Lynn Ardle was the best person, and we're talking about Gordon Bilney and a chook raffle, but we'll come back to the chook raffle anecdote.
I've got some words to say about that.
Yeah, we'll come back to the chook raffle in a moment. If you could just pass the mic to Dean. Now, Dean, based on this conversation, if you just fell out of the sky, you'd think, all right, it was a lay-down mazair. The Liberals, all they got to do is stand up and don't remember your lines and don't bump into the furniture and you'll win. There was a complicating factor, wasn't it? And that was Jeff Kennett, because he'd been elected before this election had been held. He'd been elected in Victoria and he was slashing and burning, and you had to bear that in mind. People were worried what you were going to do.
And the same in Western Australia as well, to a lesser extent.
Yeah. So how did you deal with that?
Well, there were three key elements of the election campaign that I set out as my objectives. The first was to build trust with the South Australian public. And that was the number one priority. And that was developed by, I hope, over the 18 months period that I was leader of the opposition. And clearly, the polls were starting to show that. Secondly, it had to show to the South Australian public that it was absolutely essential to grow the economy, develop new industries, expand existing ones. Unemployment was extremely high, the highest of mainland Australia. We had a negative 3.6% private investment in the 12 months running up to the election, whereas the rest of Australia had a positive 5%, and things were going backwards. A lot of people, as Lynn would remember, a lot of people packed up, went from South Australia to Queensland in particular, and businesses followed with them. We had a huge net migration out of the state. So it was very important to develop a partnership with all the industry sectors and to gain their confidence that we could grow the economy. The other advantage of growing the economy was the debt as a proportion of the economy also then shrank, and that was one way of tackling the debt together with debt reduction strategy. And the third was to convince the South Australian public that we were not like the Victorian public government in particular. We weren't going to slash and burn.
And you weren't going to introduce a tax, I think, Jeff Kennett, and that would be a very controversial issue.
I came down with a policy very early in the piece, no new taxes and government charges to increase by CPI only. Now, a lot of people, including a number of people in my own party, opposed that, but we stuck to it and we didn't increase taxation, and it was part of developing a trust with the public.
To put this in some sort of context, we'd gone into a national recession, but South Australia had entered that. We entered it before anybody else. This is in the early 90s. And we were the last to leave.
To come out of it.
Yeah, and there was massive changes going on right around the world in terms of IT and computers. I remember being at a press conference, and you knew you didn't have any money because the state was skint. And so you had to work out a way of bringing in private investment. And you said, we're going to outsource IT. We're about 15 minutes into the press conference, and John Ferguson, who's now gone on to work for The Australian in Victoria, he put up his hand and he said, look, I'm sorry, Mr. Brown, but I haven't understood a word you've said for the last 15 minutes. And everybody in the room was so relieved because we didn't know what IT and outsourcing was. So you had to educate us that you were going to take the only thing that the state really had, which was a whole lot of contracts over a whole lot of government departments, bundle them up together and sell it and say to a company like EDS, if you come and we'll give you everything to do, but you've got to invest. That was an education you had to give us.
It was more than that. Information technology was the fastest growing segment of any economy worldwide during that period, both outsourcing and software development.
and software applications. And so there was an opportunity to bring in overseas capital, to bring in overseas companies, and we were very successful as a result of that contract in attracting all the top IT companies of the world pretty well to South Australia to set up their Australian headquarters or their regional headquarters. The other big advantage was that it would save money because the government had lost, and Lynn probably remembers this, $50 million in the previous year through costs blowing out on a law court's computer system and some other computer system. And the trouble is that governments are very poor at determining what sort of computer system to put in place because they're so slow in making decisions. And so by bringing in an outside firm that could make decisions overnight and have all their international experience and capability brought was a way of overcoming that. And we actually halved the costs of data processing.
Now, Lynn,
I should just add one further point. A condition of the contract, 50% was based on cost and 50% was based on what new economic activity they'd bring to South Australia.
Yeah.
And they had to create $550 million of new activity.
Now, if you just pass the mic back to Lynn. Lynn, were you and your party, as you were hearing Dean and the Liberals, you know, paint this brave new world, were you thinking, yeah, actually, that's what's got to happen? Or were you thinking, my God, this is exactly what we don't want to happen?
Well, I think we need to also understand a little bit of the immediate prehistory in the 2 years prior to that election. One, during the Bannon premiership, the A.D. Little report was commissioned, which was looking at the four major strategic areas for the state. And they were strategic areas that remained valid for a long period of time. And then in my premiership, we had Meeting the Challenge, which was an economic statement of some considerable substance. And dare I say, I believe that the recommendations of that, which we accepted as a state government, actually were de facto accepted by our successors, because many of the things in that report ultimately were followed by the Liberal government. So we believe we had laid some very solid groundwork. Now, that's not to say that the incoming government then didn't do other things that took the things to the new areas beyond that, and I acknowledge that, for example, in the health area, in health expenditures and so on. But you mentioned IT. Well, IT had been a benighted area and remained a benighted area after the election too, I might add, for some years with EDS. But the broader issue of IT, we all could see that the future was going to make massive changes in this regard. And I think we were picking up the sense of that in the Meeting the Challenge report.
Now, in the meantime, on the ground, again, to these very inexperienced eyes at the time, it just looked like the Wild West in terms of Labor's campaign, because it was every MP for himself. Understandably, you couldn't find Frank Blevins, the treasurer. He was nowhere to be seen in the city. We spent 5 weeks looking for him. Frank, very sensibly, just hightailed it back to Whyalla, and he held his seat.
My PhD is in social linguistics, and it's about the way people say things. Everyone was for themselves, I think, actually grossly misrepresents what was happening. They had to save their seats, that's true, and campaign in their seats. And Frank, even as Deputy Premier, spent more time there than elsewhere. But they did not jump ship from the Labor campaign. They held remarkably tight. They could easily have gone feral, notwithstanding the episode we'll mention a bit later. But they did not do so. One of the things I'm very proud about is that during this campaign, where we knew we were going to lose, each of the policy areas gave substantive policy announcements with the relevant minister and myself as premier, and they were really substantive things that we said we would like to do if we were re-elected. This was not just Mickey Mouse stuff. These were things we actually believed in. We wanted them on the public record so that maybe at some future time they could be revisited.
Yeah. Well, Frank Blevins taught me a lot that campaign. He was there was a lot of pressure. Where is Frank Blevins, the treasurer? And I was doing a Q&A, a young reporter with Keith Conlon, who was, you know, the anchoring the morning program for ABC 891. And the weeks went by until finally Frank rang me on a Sunday morning at home, and I'm standing there in my boxer shorts, and he says, "Right, young man, you want to talk? Let's talk now." And what do I do? And I said, I mean, now I'd say to him, "I'm not going to play this game, Frank. We'll talk tomorrow at Monday at 8:30. But he showed me the ropes then. But it was clear why he was doing what he had to do. Yeah. Okay, so you get to election night.
David, can I just pick up this issue? The 6.5 week campaign.
Yeah.
We polled, the Liberal Party polled every night in what we put down initially as the key marginal seats. And there were about 7 or 8 seats that we wanted to win. And a few that we had to monitor to make sure we didn't lose. And the polling showed us that there wasn't all that much difference between the two parties.
Really?
The longer the campaign went, the more the votes dropped dramatically our way. And about 3 weeks before the election, I actually said, look, we'll abandon these seats, or most of these seats we've been polling, and we'll turn to another 5. And we turned to another 5. And we won all of those plus more. We were still very concerned because the people were saying about 6 weeks before the about a week out from the election, we were very worried. They were still saying it's going to be slash and burn, isn't it? And we had to convince them not to.
Was it a dirty campaign?
No, it was very clean.
On both sides?
My view was very clean.
Yes, it was a very clean campaign. I think one of the mistakes of the long campaign, I mean, our polling was showing bad results right from the start, so we didn't track what your polling was saying on that. What we did, I think, find is that the Liberal Party went to ground for the first 3 weeks of the campaign.
Right.
And that was a very clever strategy, really. It meant that we were shadow boxing for 3 weeks before we got into the real stuff. And that did cost us energy. So we were tired by the time the 6 weeks had come.
Yeah.
And Lynn, in that first 3 weeks of the campaign, you kept... or your spokespeople kept saying, where's the Liberal Party strategy for reducing debt? And we had made it very clear, and Stephen Baker's here, we'd made it very clear, we'd bring out our debt reduction strategy 1 week before the campaign. We made no secret of that. We said that before the election, and we stuck to it. And it therefore created the expectation or the ability for us every time we were asked, where is the Liberals' debt reduction strategy, to say, but who created the debt? Who's forcing $730 million a year to be paid for interest payments on this debt, which was incidentally about 9.5%.
Right. So you get to election night. Tell us about the chook raffle then.
Well, there's two things I want to say about election night itself. I'm in Trades Hall, which then existed on South Terrace, and the party secretary, Terry Cameron, and I were watching the results come in, and clearly... Oh, well, no, I need to go back a bit earlier. I'd been rung by Channel 7 earlier in the afternoon if I would comment on the exit polling that was coming out. And the exit polling that they told me over the phone about 4 o'clock in the afternoon was disastrous. It made the election result look good. We would have lost more seats if that exit polling had have carried through to the whole night.
Just to remind people, 47 people in the parliament, and you ended up winning 10.
Yep. If that exit polling had have held out, to the whole day, we would have lost more seats than that. Now, it taught me a very important lesson about how people vote. And I remember on the morning, and Dean, you might remember this, on the morning, the queues were long. Because there was an animus there. People wanted to get things off their chest. And those people who were particularly angry at the government were going to get out early and vote. Other people who were less fussed about the thing were going to take their time through the day. So they were not where the swing was. The swing was with these people with the animus. And so they were being exit polled. So my lesson out of that was, be careful when you see exit polling, because it doesn't necessarily, if there's a particularly contentious election, it doesn't necessarily reflect what will end up happening by the end of the day. Okay, so we come to the end of the day. I'm sitting there in Trades Hall. The results are coming in, and we're losing. And so I pick up the phone, and I ring Dean, and I say, Dean, I will be shortly conceding. I ask that you don't make any announcement until I've had the chance to go to my electoral function in direct primary school, that I have the chance to concede, and then it's all yours. But on the way, because of what had happened just 8 days earlier, one of our candidates in the South, who did not get elected that election, he would get elected at a subsequent election and would go on to serve with great esteem in the Parliament and the Cabinet. In fact, he'd write a book about being a cabinet minister. But he had a campaign director, one Gordon Bilney, who was one of our federal colleagues, in inverted commas, in the federal parliament. And Gordon Bilney decided to take the ploy, and it was the one example we had of a state seat campaign that ran feral. He said, look, the state government could not run a chook raffle. Do not hold it against this candidate. Vote for him,
John Hill.
On the night of the election, I stopped off at the late night supermarket in O'Connell Street, picked up a frozen chook, and picked up a book of raffle tickets, and went out to the election party. Another story I have to interleave here.
Wait! Who won the chook?
You've got to wait for the end. Wait! Just one other story I must interleave here, because it's relevant to my arrival at the election night party. My wife and my mother were there with our five children. My father was off volunteering in India at the Christian Medical College in Vellore, so he wasn't there. My mother had said to our children, do not let them see you cry. Put on a brave face for your dad. And so I get there, and there on the little veranda outside the front of this primary school are five kids, preteens and teens, and they are smiling. It was the most moving thing I can recall. They held it all in, and later that evening, two of them, in fact, would go off and vomit because they were under such tension of not wanting to let their dad down. And I'm so proud of how they were not going to let the side down. Anyway, come to the chook raffle. The chook raffle was held. I forget who won it. Somebody won it. We got the money from the chook raffle. It was handed to one of the officers of the sub-branch, and so we ran a chook raffle. Except that, some months later in my electorate office, I say, by the way, we have banked that money, haven't we? And it turned out nobody could quite find where the money was. So it actually looked like we couldn't run a chook raffle. I had to put the money in out of my own pocket.
Yeah, it sort of sums up the Labor Party in the 1993. Now, Dean, your problem after the election was you had too many MPs. You had more MPs than you knew what to do with. And for the next 3 or 4 years, they're going to run around looking for stuff to do, and they're going to cause you all sorts of grief. Did it occur to you on election, I've been too successful? Because you were.
Not really at that stage.
Right.
No.
Okay, that came to you later, didn't it?
Well, they all had big ambitions and all expected to be re-elected at the next election.
Yeah. And they were some of them
and
were
that
onces.
Was never going to occur.
No, some of them were onces. Yeah. Yeah. Okay. So within days of the election, you get news the Grand Prix has been lost. Can you describe that for us? Because, all right, economies aren't run on bread and circuses, but it did have a yet another psychological blow to the state.
On the Wednesday afternoon after the election, my office received a phone call from Ron Walker of Melbourne. And Ron Walker said, "I must come and see you, Dean." And I said, "Well, Ron, we've just had an election. We're forming government. We've got some other priorities." He said, "No, I must come and see you." So I said, "Fine, we'll come the next day, just after lunch." Ron Walker arrived, pulls out of his pocket a piece of paper, and there was a signature by Bernie Eccleston saying that the Grand Prix had been taken over by Melbourne and that Ron had effectively bought it with a very large amount of money. Mm. I said, "Well, Ron, I accept your word, I accept your piece of paper, but I'd like to speak to Bernie Eccleston." So I rang Bernie Eccleston Thursday afternoon, and Bernie Eccleston's in London, and I don't know, Lynn, you've met Bernie. Oh, incidentally, Ron told me that you'd been to see Bernie Eccleston in September, I think.
Previous January.
Right. And he said, as you walked out, he was sitting in the foyer going up to see Bernie. And that's when he got the signature on the piece of paper. I rang Bernie and Bernie Eccleston. And Bernie said, "Oh, I'm not sure about that." And I said, "Well, Bernie, can you look up your files and look up your contracts and confirm it with me? And I'll ring you back in an hour's time." Well, an hour went by and I tried Bernie and he wasn't answering his phone. And another hour later, he still wasn't answering his phone. And finally, after about seven or eight phone calls, we got Bernie. And Bernie says, "Yes, that's right. Mm. It's gone to Victoria."
Now, Lynn, what's your memory of what happened?
Yes, what happened in January of that year, I was on a trade mission to the UK, to Europe, and I met with Bernie Eccleston. I had my advisor, one of my advisors, Ray Garan, with me. We sat in Bernie's flat and we talked about the Grand Prix, and we agreed that we would face the cameras outside the front, and Channel 7 still had this on film many, many years later. And there in front of the cameras, Bernie said what we had agreed would be said by him as at our meeting in his flat. And he said, "The Grand Prix is Adelaide's as long as they want it, subject to negotiation about the price." And that was as good a deal as you could expect, because frankly, what else? You couldn't expect anything more than that. I came back from that trip and I told Cabinet and I said to Mike Rann, "You're in charge of handling these negotiations to make sure we get it. Do as good a job as you can on getting the best price you can." I can't remember if it was about July or August, he came back to me and he said, "I have to tell you, the price issues are really, really tough. We're doing what we can." But we still went to the election believing this was still ours to have. Now, election night had been, I won't call it shattering, because we knew we were going to lose. Mm. So to that extent, there was a psychological preparation for that happening. But the week later, when you rang me on the following Friday, Dean, you rang, "Lynn, I need to tell you, we've lost the Grand Prix." That was truly shattering. I was absolutely flabbergasted and floored by this, because I'd been with this man who had said, "It's as yours as long as you want it, subject to negotiation by the price." We later discovered that Ray and Lloyd had been in negotiations with Bernie as far back as January, and I think the meeting that you're talking about was when Mike would have been to see Bernie in September. So that Bernie had already sold us out. Mm. And the perfidy of that, I found something like I'd never seen the like of before. And I'd been in politics 15 years and I'd never seen that sort of perfidy in politics. Mm. And now I was a victim, or we were a victim as a state of it. And so that was a truly shattering experience. Yeah. There were two more conversations that afternoon. One is somebody rang the Liberal Party headquarters, and you were running a message thing about Labor has lost the Grand Prix for Adelaide. I rang you back to say, Dean, that's what the party office is saying. Could you please stop it? And to your credit, you did. Thank you.
Mm. Now, gentlemen, okay,
end that.
Yeah.
I mean, the very fact that Bernie didn't acknowledge to me he had signed it over to Victoria says a great deal.
Great deal.
I went and saw Bernie in January.
Yeah. Now, we'll open it up for questions. But just to wrap up, because we've gone through the last part of just before the election year and then the election campaign, Dean Brown and the Liberals have now won. Now, within 4 years, Dean would lose the premiership in a party room coup to John Olsen. John Olsen will go to the polls and be reduced to a minority government, and Labor will be back as a viable force. Now, we're not revisiting those events tonight. That's not the purpose of tonight's anniversary. But what I put to you, Dean Brown, is that what you did achieve following that election result has always been seen through the prism of the turmoil that later followed. So I'll ask you to see it as it happened. And I'll ask you to strip away perhaps what is too often an unfair prism. What did you achieve when you got that chance? And then I'd like Lynn to give us his thoughts. I mean, was it an epoch-changing result? Was South Australia forever different? Good, bad, indifferent? Dean Brown, what did you achieve?
If you look at it, we worked industry by industry to grow those industries. And as a result of that, and we've talked about the information technology industry and computing, and you had almost, as I said, every major IT company in the world come here. We developed an IT 2000 strategy, which was then mirrored by Singapore. Secondly, we set out to expand industries like the wine industry. It was relatively small at that stage. You had developed a Premier's Council, I think, Wine Council, and we developed that and worked with them, and we promised to treat effluent water from Christie's Beach and other effluent plants and to recycle that back down to the McLaren Vale area. And as a result, three times the acreage of vines in McLaren Vale was planted, which led to a huge expansion of the wine industry. We altered the licences around Lake Alexandrina for the Langhorne Creek wine growers, and that increased the plantings from 1,100 acres to over 20,000 acres by the time we'd got about 4 or 5 years down the way. We had, prior to the election, signed an agreement with the aquaculture and the tuna industry at Port Lincoln, and we grew their exports from $25 million a year up to $300 million a year. We put down a commitment prior to the election of growing our exports by 15%. And we worked through, I've given you just some examples of, we started the Southern Expressway, which was designed.
You copped a lot of flak over the Southern Expressway.
It was designed as a two-way road. It wasn't our fault, it wasn't my fault or Diana's fault that subsequent governments didn't build the other half. because they didn't provide the funding. We provided and designed it as a two-way road.
Yeah.
And after stage one had been finished, stage two was to progress, which it didn't. And the other thing we did is put a lot of effort into tourism infrastructure. You may recall, under John Bannon, numerous tourism projects, Kangaroo Island, Flinders Rangers, Wilpena Pound, Glenelg, all failed. There's a list of about seven or eight of them, which we talked about in the Parliament. And we committed to building new visitor centres on Kangaroo Island, at Penashore, at Seal Bay, a new resort up in Wilpena Pound, accommodation, McLaren Vale Visitor Centre. So there was a large number of facilities we got on and built. Now, they're just some of the examples.
Well then, Lynn, your thoughts then, just to wrap it up, before we open it up to questions from the audience. When you look back on that campaign and all of the effort, the blood, sweat and tears, and it continued on into 1994 until you would say, look, I got the boat in. We hit the wharf, but we saved as many people as we could. What do you think it was all about? What did you achieve?
Well, first of all, Dean, in some of the things you've acknowledged there, because they were well laid out in the meeting, the economic challenge that I launched in May of 1993.
See, it was his idea.
That was going to say that any government would have been crazy not to have done the sorts of things that needed to be done in the wine industry and the other industries that you refer to. So what you did in honouring that, was obviously the logical thing to do. On the tourism side, by the way, the wine industry had been growing gangbusters before 1993. It continued to go gangbusters after that.
So wouldn't it have mattered then? Are you saying it wouldn't have mattered whether a miracle had happened and you'd been re-elected? Or did the state need that
probably
election?
Okay, did the state need a lancing of the boil? And I suspect that's the answer to that is yes.
Right.
I wanted us to win. We wanted to win. We fought as hard as we could to win. If we had won, would that have been a good thing? I think the answer is no. Because I think there needed to be a circuit breaker in the community to allow us to move on from the State Bank, which had started to dominate everything and take away from all the other things that had been achieved in the previous 15 years. And in a kind of way, there was testimony to that at the by-election just a few months afterwards, when we achieved a swing back to us 1% higher than the swing we had against us at the state election.
So that was
only a matter of 6 months after when Joe Tierney sadly died. He was a great bloke, but I'm sorry that he died.
So are you saying that sometimes in life, certainly in politics, it's important to fight like you're going to win, even though it's important that you lose?
That's an interesting way of putting it. I guess I actually don't believe it's a good thing for any one party to be in government too long. In a 50-year cycle, I think at most you really want to have at least four cycles of government. In other words, a maximum about 12 years per cycle. Beyond that, I think it's ready for some change. And I can actually remember Neil Blewett saying that with Norm Foster when he was the candidate for Sturt in 1972 at the Campbelltown Town Hall, a big public rally out on the lawns out there, and Neil said, look, it's time. And I hope I have the courage to say in 10, 15, 20 years' time, it's time again for another change the other way. And I truly believe that I think Queensland has showed the danger over 80 years of having one party, then the other party, each dominating politics for excessively long periods of time.
Okay. Now, you want to say something, then we're going to
just
open it up.
A couple of extras. The Northern Territory government, the South Australian government, signed an agreement to build the railway from Alice Springs to Darwin. We both put $100 million towards it. It was subsequently done. And I think that was a great achievement. We reduced the debt by $1 billion more than laid down by the Labor government. And as a result of that, it became a manageable debt, and we stuck to our election commitment to reduce it by within 4 years. The other big thing was the River Murray. And it was the Liberal Party here, I as Premier, and David Watton, came out and said we needed to immediately put a freeze on additional allocations from the river or Murray-Darling Basin, and we need to have an audit carried out. And both of those, I flew off and talked to the other state premiers. They agreed, and that really became the start of the basin plan. And for the first time, some control over how much water was extracted from the River Murray.
Okay. Now, there's probably an even longer list.
Yeah, there is.
But we'll open it up. I think we have another mic. We've got about 20 minutes before we have to wrap up. There must be people here who've got their own questions. If you have, just pop your hand up. And there we are, gentleman at the back. Now, do you need one of these mics? You need, Dean? Well, I'll leave. They're going to ask, they'll want you to answer. So
you thank you. I won't do the ABC resources joke again.
No. Sorry.
Thank you very much. This question is probably more so to Dean than, to Lynn than it is Dean. And we've touched on the Victorian state election, which was obviously a year and a half prior to the South Australian election. At that election, Labor was facing a wipeout, and Joan Kerner basically went into what we would call the red wall seats now, ran a campaign to try and hold those districts, and she was successful. And on election night in 1992, her whole focus was, thanking Labor supporters in their heartland for sticking with Labor when they had looked like that they would be departing. So I was just interested to know what lessons did you learn from what Labor did in 1992 in Victoria, and did you apply them here?
Well, Dean was quite right that we tried to tar the South Australian Liberal Party with the Kennett brush, and we tried to bring people over here from Victoria to say, this is what's happening in Victoria, this is what's going to happen here. And Dean and his team quite effectively deflected that, obviously to the electorate's content. But we felt that could be a good strategy for us to do. It begs the question, of course, as to whether after the election the Liberal Party hadn't tied itself down too much and left itself a little option to do major things that might have been major dramatic changes. And I suspect that there's some truth to that too, that South Australia continued to languish for some time, and that may be because of that. But we didn't just have a campaign to try and keep the red wall, as you describe it. And I remember one of the seats in the northeast, and they, of course, were traditionally the swing seats. I was asked as premier by the party office, could you ring these 41 numbers? And I said, well, why? Well, we think these are swinging voters. It's a secret ballot and all that. We think these are swinging voters. How do you know? Oh, well, it's all and both sides had their own polling mechanisms and the record keeping that they were doing about people and profiling with collector districts of census data and all this sort of stuff. Ours was poll file. The Liberal Party had their own equivalent. Well, I rang these 41 households, and I was breathtaking. My breath was taken away. Blow me down, they all were genuinely swinging seats. The analysis of who was who was so well predicted that they picked these 41 houses were, in fact, swinging voters. Obviously, they didn't swing to us, and my call might have made a difference, but the election was lost by more than 41 votes.
Lynn, are you saying that the Brown government was too soft?
Well, I'm not saying they should have been a Kennett government after they got in, but I suspect that they may have constrained themselves from major change. And Dean's highlighted a number of the things they did, and he's quite right. I'm saying a number of the things we would have done anyway, but he's also highlighted some things that we didn't do and that they did do, and that's full credit to them. But I think in terms of raising the agenda, the heat of the agenda, they missed some opportunities there. And the state was ready for some kind of circuit breaker.
Well, you would have sold ETSA.
And we would not have sold ETSA.
You would not have sold.
No, if you remember rightly, we had in our meeting the challenge. We were going to amalgamate ENWS and ETSA to make it sale proof or as much sale proof as possible. But nevertheless, that's just a personal view of mine that things might have turned out a bit differently.
We got another question. Just pop up your hand. Hello, Clem McIntyre.
Thank you very much. And thanks to both of you for a really fascinating evening. I've enjoyed every minute of it. I want to pick up on a point that Lynn made about the need for periodic turnovers of government, and if a government is in office too long, it begins to lose its efficacy, its strength, and so on. And although, Dean, you acknowledged, or you didn't acknowledge that on the night, the landslide, you saw maybe was storing up problems, but a massive majority often doesn't always lead to the strongest and most disciplined government. Is this possibly a tacit argument for some sort of electoral reform and moving away from single-member constituencies and huge, you know, winner-take-all majorities?
I don't think so.
And I agree with him.
Tammy Franks from the Greens, she's agreeing.
That's what you always do.
Yeah, yeah. Another question? Yes, sir.
So as well as the Victorian election, there was the Commonwealth election in March 1993, and obviously state elections are very different from federal elections, but was there any kind of impact about the Liberals losing the unlosable election? But did it have any impact upon the campaign and so forth?
Oh, well, it publicly gave us some cause for rejoicing, but I think and my cabinet colleagues who are here tonight can agree or disagree with me. I don't think we fooled ourselves that was going to be translatable to us at a state level. It did, of course, have the good benefit that in terms of Keating cleaning the balance sheet from his point of view, he bowls up in Adelaide one morning some weeks before that election was called with an offer that was too good to refuse to help finance the sale of the state bank. That, from his point of view, was cleaning up the federal political agenda for South Australia for him, and it helped us all as South Australians too.
Yep. He would also give you a deal for the South Eastern Freeway, or was that previously? Was that before then?
Yeah, I don't remember that.
No.
No, that was previous.
That was previous. Okay. Paul Keating.
Much of the South Eastern Freeway was done by Playford.
Yeah. Oh, yeah. But in terms of the tunnels and things like that, that were put in, but
no,
Paul
that came later.
That came later. Another
question? That came during the period I was Premier.
Right. Paul Keating, a great friend of state Liberal governments.
Incidentally, David, I tried to get Paul Keating to take some action over the River Murray, and he just refused to take any action at all.
Wasn't interested. Okay. Stephen Baker. Stephen Baker, for those who don't remember, was Dean Brown's treasurer and delivered those first few budgets.
Mm, yes. Thanks, David. Just quickly, just a couple of things. There's been this myth about electricity and what has happened with the privatisation of electricity. Were you at the COAG meeting of 1991 when Paul Keating insisted that all state enterprises had to be competitive and all monopolies had to be broken up? Were you at that meeting?
I was certainly at the COAG meeting, and by the way, at that meeting, we had, I think Frank Blevins was with me, we expressed our concern at that meeting about the proposals of the breaking up, and it didn't mean you had to privatise the broken up elements.
They had to be broken up, didn't they, rather than amalgamated. And the other thing I'd like to sort of ask is
of amalgamating water.
Well, yeah, I know.
And
bigger monopolies, I know. It was right against what Paul Keating didn't want to happen. But the second thing was the issue of the single lane on the South Road was very simple. Our Director of Transport then said, you've got to put the Darlington interchange. We were broke, right? We had no money whatsoever. Because we'd made a commitment, the single lane got built with a capacity to, in fact, put in two lanes. But the big number was the Darling Interchange, and that finally got completed. Thanks very much.
Yeah. Was that a question?
Just to follow on from what Stephen said about Paul Keating, he introduced this principles of competition. And we had, I think, four or five premiers conferences as they were then, I think they'd call them National Cabinet today, meetings in 92, 94, and again in 95 and 96. And Paul Keating laid down the fact that we had to make each of the state enterprises, break them up, turn them into commercial enterprises, tax them as if they were commercial enterprises. He also actually recommended the abolition of King's Council and Queen's Council and introduced SCs, Senior Council. And I think it was New South Wales under Bob Carr did that, but we refused and Victoria refused.
Yes, yeah, I think we've just got a few more minutes.
Thank you for an excellent evening. I manage the research services section in the Parliament Library at the moment, and one of the things that we are asked to do in the wake of an election is to provide information regarding polling booth results and so forth. And at the moment, we have the benefit of being able to visualise that in an easier to digest form than would have been available at the time of the 1993 election. So I'm just curious to know how you went about analysing the aftermath and that sort of thing. I'd just be interested in the procedures involved back in that time.
Well, the aftermath for us was essentially, yes, we'd look at all the polling results, and we did. I can't remember how it came out in terms of differences between polling booths. The 79 election, if I can take us back way further, we did do some individual polling booth analysis, which showed that those polling booths that were centred on railway lines had smaller swings against the Corcoran Labor government than those booths that were centred on bus routes. And for those who remember the 79 election and the bus strikes, it says it all. There wasn't quite such a clear-cut division of that kind in the 93 election. It was pretty much all going to go pear-shaped around the place. What we did as a Labour opposition was to say, well, we've got to make sure that we're back out there listening to the people. And Mike Rann, who was always a strong person on this issue, went on a listening campaign through all the Labour Party sub-branches, but also inviting people in the wider community to be part of a Labour Listens campaign to say, obviously, after all these years in government, something went wrong. And yes, we know the obvious elephant in the room of the State Bank, but there has to be other things that we maybe should be listening to. So that was our main emphasis, rather than going through the entrails of the polling booths.
Gentlemen,
certainly... The Liberal Party looked at issues that had arisen as a result of our polling, and they showed very strongly that there was a complete lack of confidence in the present Labor government, that was, to create economic activity, new industries, encourage new investment in the state, and the growth of the state economy was very much at the fore rather than, in some ways, even the State Bank and the debt that had been created. So they were looking at the future, not so much as what had occurred in the past.
Ralph Clark, you were Mike Rann's deputy in the Labor Party that survived that election. Your question?
Well, perhaps at this stage more of a quick comment. I might say, Len, under your leadership, and when we lost in 93 so horribly, the fact of the matter is the party stuck like the proverbial to a blanket. Whatever factions, whatever, we couldn't have factions really much amongst 10 people in the lower house. I think I got into the shadow cabinet because there's no one left to fill the 13. But the reality of it boiled down to when Labor loses, like we did in 2018, and in 1993, 2018, of course, was minor compared to 1993, we stuck solid. We worked as a united team under both your leadership and Mike Rann. The difference between us and the Liberals is at the end of the day, we know who our friends are and we know who our political enemies are. And fortunately for us, the Liberal Party are magnificent at falling apart. Even when they win government, they just don't like one another. Now, the last point I'd make, if I could, as a more humorous note, the Labor Listens campaigns. There was a time I went, myself, Mike Cran, our then candidate in 1997 for Stewart, Ben Brown, and a couple of other shadow ministers for a Labor listens, and we were going to listen to the small business in Port Augusta. Well, we'd leafleted the area, and when we came to the Coinda Club at Port Augusta to have that meeting, we were sitting there, waiting, waiting. Not a soul turned up. Not even Graham Gunn sent a cockatoo to spy on us, which there was the Liberal member for that area. Now, could you believe you wouldn't even spy on your opposition? So, but to show you how Mike worked, as we were leaving the Coinda Club room we were in, we heard this music, country and western music. And Mike stuck his head around the door. And there was a boot scooting class going on. 200 predominantly middle-aged women. And he looked at me and the other members and said, "We're going boot scooting." I said, "What?" He said, he went in, introduced himself to the lady who was conducting the boot scooting, who was overwhelmed by the interest shown. And we all went in, wore cowboy hats, and I've never done boot scooting before or since. A man of my size, for example, and Mike was enjoying himself. We loved it. And he said, "There might be 200 people here today. They're going home to their husbands or boyfriends or partners tonight. They'll be talking to their neighbours or workmates tomorrow. We've done well today. We've probably got our message out that we've been here amongst 1,500 to 2,000 people." That was Mike's campaign.
And that is how you rebuild a Labor Party. And the very last question will go to you.
Hello. My name's Natalie and I manage the community education and engagement programs for the Parliament. And one of the roles of our job is to inspire young people and the population generally to participate in parliamentary processes and have trust and faith in Parliament as an institution and our democracy generally. And I was interested in your reflections of the changes that you've seen in the public's attitude and relationship with our South Australian democracy in the 30 years since, with, you know, the increase of social media and digital presences. I'm interested in your reflections on the state of democracy then and the state of our democracy now.
I'll start. The Parliament, I believe the Parliament today is dramatically different from the Parliament that I first went into in the 1970s. In the 1970s, there were some basic rules that were put down that we all adhered to, and that was that you could talk to any other opposition minister or member in the Parliament outside the chamber. You could have a detailed discussion and debate, if you like, and I used to have plenty with Hugh Hudson, but you never ever repeated what went on outside the chamber, inside the chamber. And secondly, there was an unwritten rule that you never brought personalities and personal events into it. And I can recall, and I won't detail the various events, but I can recall, for instance, one Member of Parliament being up for domestic violence, and we didn't say a word in the Parliament. No one mentioned it whatsoever, even though the person was found guilty. And so today, I think, and particularly with social media, that has changed and it's gone out the window. The standards and the principles that applied in the Parliament in the 1970s was gradually lost, I think, in the 1980s. And, well, no, still largely there in the 80s and 90s, but disappeared as we got to after the 2000. And I think it's to the detriment of democracy that that has occurred. And the same, I think, applies with the media as well. The media could learn things or hear stories, but they wouldn't repeat them and they wouldn't print them.
I think you're right that there's been seems to have been a deterioration in the esprit de corps that exists in parliaments. And my 15 years were a time of great challenge. I used to say a third of the time was good, a third was bad, a third was terrible, but it could have been worse, so I was happy. But in fact, but there was a camaraderie across the chamber that we could actually do something really positive and build on. When I take people on a tour of Parliament House, take visitors here, I always point out the lobbies behind the two chambers. And I point out the fact that lobbies were symbols of the important capacity to talk to one another in confidence, hold the confidence, and then in public say other things. And that was an important feature of the Westminster system. But you actually raised the point about young people. And I can't quote exact figures because they're not coming to my mind right at the moment. But we have been seeing, and you may have too, surveys have been done, not just in Australia, but in Western democracies generally, certainly English-speaking Western democracies, about an alienation of young people from the democratic process, where a significant minority of young people, I mean, I think we're talking figures of the order of 40 and 45%, do not see the merit in democracy as a preferred system to any other system. And that is surely very alarming, because if we're not going to believe in the liberal democracy as the essence of what gives us the kind of society we have, if that's at risk in terms of significant portions of future generations being prepared to say, it doesn't really matter, then it will be a very, very sorry outcome.
Lynn, there's a very interesting article in the latest edition of The Economist on that very point, and indicating that in South Africa, for instance, a majority of people now are opposed to a democracy, according to the polls. And they go through the reasons why that is the case. So I think it's a very fundamental issue that we have to face, and the parliaments or our political leaders need to face, so that they have young people in particular have greater confidence in where the democratically elected governments go.
Gentlemen, thank you very much. Ladies and gentlemen, Dean Brown and Lynn Arnold.
Well, ladies and gentlemen, can I... by way of closing, again, thank you all for coming along here tonight. As I say, proceedings have been recorded, so it's on the record, Stephen, and everyone else who's here. I think at an occasion where we're recognising 30 years since that significant election, it's going to be undoubtedly the case that the room is filled with those who inhabit that history of decades. So for the possibility that people have to stick around and have conversations after we conclude the formalities, then certainly take that opportunity. I just might say, apart from hopefully this sort of forum providing the opportunity to build the kind of fabric of goodwill and harmony, let alone pride in what goes on in the place, it's certainly a very serious matter of concern that we do need to look for those ways to reinforce the quality and productivity of our democracy, including what goes on in both of the chambers of this House. We hugely appreciate Lynn, Dean, taking the time to come and to share those recollections of 30 years. And in saying thanks tonight, it's a particular pleasure and privilege to, I think, join forces with you, David Bevan, facilitating this discussion tonight. You've clearly not only lived through all that our former premiers lived through and reported on it, but you've prepared very carefully for tonight, and you've engaged with everybody and brought this whole discussion to life. So thank you in particular, David. Yeah.